You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to Table Talk, a guide to the future of food and nutrition, brought to you by Food Matters, and this episode is made in partnership with Accenture. In these podcasts, we chat with visionaries from across the food industry to discover the ideas that will transform our food landscape. I'm Stefan Gates, I'm a food science writer, I'm a broadcaster, and all-round gastronaut. Now, for us shoppers, the past year has shown supermarkets in a pretty positive light. There were a few problems with supply in March 2020, but these were solved pretty quickly, and then retailers hugely expanded delivery services. We also recognise supermarkets' value in ensuring the elderly and vulnerable get their groceries and in reliably sourcing produce to ensure the nation is fed. But from the grocer's point of view, there are problems. Supermarkets have seen their profits take a significant hit, despite booming sales, because they've had to spend millions on extra staffing costs and new hygiene practices. And many of us have made the permanent shift to home delivery, where the margins are lower. So, in the intensely competitive world of grocery shopping, how can supermarkets sustain safety in store, keep new online shoppers, and attract those who want to shop locally, and still make a profit? Well, this episode, made in partnership with Accenture, and two members of their team are with me to discuss this new era of the supermarket shop. Suzanne Robinson, Director of Innovation for Consumer Goods at What If, part of Accenture. Hello there, Suzanne.
Hi, Stefan. Good to be here.
Lovely to have you. And Matt Jeffers, who runs the Digital Retail Strategy Service Line for Javelin Group, part of Accenture Strategy. Hello there, Matt.
Hi, Stefan. Good to meet you.
Now, Matt, from the outside looking in, it appears that supermarkets have done well during the pandemic. They stayed open. They've seen a surge in online shoppers. But what's going on behind the scenes? Is it actually a story of panic and difficult change?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, they've done very well for the most part, but obviously not to the same degree, depending on the different brands. So the brands that had larger format stores or multi-format stores, indeed, so people like Tesco's and Sainsbury's, for example, did really, really pretty well because they had larger stores, which were able to take in more customers despite the restrictions. They also had convenience stores, so closer to the customers. And then, of course, they had online. You have also people like Co-op. Did really well because they have a convenience estate, essentially, and they capitalized on the fact they were just that much closer to the customers during lockdown. Others, as you said in the introduction, just found it a bit tougher to be able to cope with that spike in demand. So Ocado, who we think of as a fantastic leading light in the world of online grocery, took a little while to be able to catch up with that surge in demand, but actually have come through it pretty well and are now experiencing 30% growth.
And there's been a huge growth in online sales generally over the year. That has a knock-on effect, really, doesn't it? How is it changing the groceries market? And is there a difference in the impact for the discounters?
Yeah, it's interesting. So before the pandemic, actually, online growth was starting to slow. It'd been really good for quite a long period of time. And then all of a sudden, people realized that the margins are not that great. In fact, you said the margins were small. They're actually negative for most online grocers. And it makes sense, right? Because all of a sudden, you're taking an industry which is constructed to be able to allow customers to self-serve with pretty low margins. All of a sudden, you're doing the work for them. So you're taking on all of those costs to be able to pick the product, to deliver the product out to their homes. So for people like Tesco's and Sainsbury's that had large businesses, they started to slow down some of the investment. Who knew that all we needed was a pandemic to kick in to all of a sudden turn the industry upside down almost overnight, and all of a sudden huge demand coming through. We've now got 14% of sales coming through the online channel compared to 6 to 7% before the pandemic. So what that's meant for the players that have an online business, they've had to invest quite a lot to be able to build up that capacity. They've added more staff into the stores to pick the items we want. They've also had to add many more drivers, more vans to be able to cope with the delivery to home. And so that huge investment has come at a cost. And so they've obviously had to train people up. And now the question is, what happens when we're all allowed our freedom back and we're allowed to be able to go into stores more often? The safety is not there in the same way. It's a question of, are we going to see the same habits sort of persist over time? Have those habits become permanent with customers?
Well, which leads me on to the question for Suzanne, really. Online shopping and food delivery has expanded enormously. I mean, it may have happened anyway, and the pandemic just accelerated the move. I'm not sure. But where does this leave the physical store? Is it still as important? Are we going to see some fundamental change in the nature of supermarkets in the future?
Yeah, I mean, it is the million-dollar question, isn't it? As Matt sort of said, I wish I had my crystal ball. I think the key thing really is to, we're trying to stay close to what we're hearing from consumers, you know, in terms of where they see the benefits and how much they value those benefits. So online is great. It's very convenient. You know, it's very immediate. And there's a growing sense of, you know, a lot of people will probably stick with a lot of those behaviours for certain items. But it was really interesting sort of talking to consumers during the pandemic, obviously virtually, but hearing their stories of how they started to look forward to going to the supermarket suddenly. That yeah. became their outing, you know, and people getting makeup on and getting dressed up and then taking their time to actually browse all of the aisles. And actually what that's done is I think it's equally sort of opened them up to products that maybe they might not have seen before, and experience. So that experiential side of it, there's sort of glimmers of, oh, I didn't see that. Oh, that sounds quite exciting. Or they're bringing home new treats. They're starting to use maybe the supermarket more in an emotional way rather than just a very transactional, very functional way. So these are early signs, but I think some of those elements actually do offer a little bit of hope and a bit of interest. And also, it's interesting, you know, the online experience, you know, people meal planning and starting to think ahead and starting to stretch their meal planning excitement and interest. They're looking for new ingredients and new things crop up. So actually, sometimes they'll look in store for things that are similar or perhaps, you know, sort of deals, etc. So I think the two things together, that there could be just a shift in terms of the relationship between them, at least in the immediate future.
So, Matt, can you give me some more information about what this might mean for the discounters?
Yeah, of course. So for the discounters, it's a real quandary what they do with digital, because if we thought that the margins are relatively low for the larger supermarkets, the multiples, the discounters are just so much lower. And so digital at the moment is not a viable channel for them from a profitability perspective. Now, that does not mean to say that they won't go into that channel. It may just mean they need to be more creative thinking about how they offer it. So you've started to see the likes of Aldi that we've worked with over the years start to think about non-food going through a digital channel and offering that. Wine, very successful for them and doing very well. And starting to experiment around the edges with using partners to be able to start delivering groceries out to customers. So it's not always just about economics. It's also about what can you learn from providing this service to customers. So can you create much more richer data sources, essentially, to be able to understand about your customer? So it may be still worth doing, even if you can't make a profit from doing so.
Do you get the sense that the multiples are just waiting to find out what the heck is going to happen when the restrictions are breaking down and they're kind of going, what? Or are they ready for it, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. The answer is they don't quite know, but actually they're in a pretty good position given the wealth of loyalty data that they have, right? So they're able to track behavior across the offline and the online channels pretty much on a real-time basis. And so they're starting to see how behavior might change. And the big question, of course, is then within that, do you go down to slightly less online grocery shopping online as you move to in-store? And does that create another set of economic problems for you because your average order values are going to start shrinking down from an online side? But I think the grocers are in a pretty good position. Of course, now they're starting to face into a world where the competition, particularly local businesses, have started to step up their game as well. And so all of a sudden, it's not quite as easy as it used to be.
And I guess it's not just the change, it's the pace of change that has caused problems. So, Suzanne, I mean, does you sort of mentioned the emotional side of shopping. Are we going to see supermarkets, the physical supermarket, needing to offer more so as an event or an emotional journey to bring people into the physical store? Is there a need for new ideas about what it means to go to the supermarket?
Well, definitely. I mean, you know, you can't go through what we've been through and just expect us everything to go back to normal. And I think the emotional side of it and the experiential side is, I mean, we were already seeing some of that in retail environments beyond food. So why would it not come into food? And I think Matt has really picked up on something around that competition on a local level and how the retailer starts to show up through the consumer's eyes in that more local environment, what they're seen to be doing to support local suppliers. Could they play a much greater role in bringing entrepreneurs to the fore? I mean, we are already starting to see that with some of the emerging growth areas in food, such as plant-based, such as, you know, fermented foods and vegan, and the rise of different health dynamics. You know, you actually are seeing retailers paying a lot more attention to smaller brands and how they can actually start to support them alongside, you know, democratizing some of these emerging, you know, food trends, et cetera, and how they can actually offer that to a broader range of people and maybe start to help consumers to navigate what is increasingly quite a complex, you know, arrangement of lots and lots of new products, new benefits, new claims, particularly around the health arena. So I think the retailer, I think their job as being that trusted portal for a lot of different categories is still very much a valid one. And bringing that to life in a way that really speaks to the consumer and connects with them, I think they still have a very, very strong role to play. I think the days of it just being about transaction has gone. But equally, you know, we're going into quite a strong economic sort of, you know, challenging time. So I think that cost consciousness and that value proposition, which has always been at the heart of a lot of supermarkets, I think, again, will be that they have a role to play to look at multiple parts of society, not just the people that might have a disposable income that allows them to invest in, you know, quite high value items on a frequent basis. So yeah,
it sounds tricky though, doesn't it? Because as you say, value and cost is really important to the shopper, but the retailers need to bring in an experiential attitude. Now, if this means working harder on selling things, having people in store, I don't know, demonstrating, what are the things? I mean, that's going to cost money as well, isn't it? I guess as supermarkets develop, all of those changes have always cost money. But is this a tipping point? Is this where things suddenly become very different? Because to create an emotional shopping experiences, I mean, that's going to cost money. It's going to take marketing. It's going to take people like you dealing with innovation. And can they still do that and hit cost and value marks as well?
Yeah, so I think it's fascinating. We're starting to see some interesting conversations with our clients about what the store of the future might start to look like. Suzanne mentioned before, you know, this idea of people getting excited about going to stores again. It was the only place they could go to. Wouldn't it be wonderful as we come out of the pandemic that people are actually excited to go and do their food shopping? I mean, that concept just didn't exist, you know, a year ago or 18 months ago. No one was that excited to go, particularly to a supermarket. And frankly, most supermarkets around the world, this is not just a UK problem, the supermarkets are pretty boring. It's the same sort of concept. It's aisles upon aisles of the same sorts of products. So supermarkets need to find that point of difference, start to consider how can they put the excitement back in there, the theater of going to a food market. We've all been to traditional food markets around the world and being wowed at the fact of the beautiful fresh produce, and you can actually have a conversation with someone about seasonality or how to cook a piece of meat or fish, get some education into the new items that are coming in into the store. That's what the supermarkets need to do, create that point of difference. But you're right, Stefan, the way to be able to do that economically is not straightforward. So starting to reinvent the way that the store looks, maybe taking out some of those products from the center store and allowing those to be fulfilled in an automated way behind the scenes, as we're starting to see in places like China now with the HEMA concept developed by Alibaba, that actually you don't pick out your cereal products, for example, anymore, because you know what you want. So you just tell them before you arrive there, that's what I want. Pick it while I'm there. I'm going to spend my time doing the fun stuff. I want to go and look at the fresh produce. I want to have conversations with people. Then just give me my items, either deliver them to home or hand them to me as I walk out at the store. And that's what retail will look like in the future.
And that's a really interesting aspect, isn't it? Because if you can turn that into a tech idea rather than lots of people, then maybe it's affordable. Do you see the gamifying of shopping? I mean, the innovations that are coming up. I mean, we need to be really clever, don't we?
Yeah, I think there's definitely an element of that coming in, and whether that's directly with the consumer themselves or starting to think about the way that you take care of some of the tasks within the store using the technology. So we're starting to see a little bit less in the way of things like replenishment, but certainly you'll see robots in the store doing things like gap scanning. Now, for those that don't know what it is, then the clue is in the name, right? You're looking for where the products are starting to run out on the shelves. And various retailers around the world have already invested in robots that will go through and look for the gaps in the shelves. That sends a message to somebody to go and replenish that shelf. We're going to see much more of that. But also on the consumer side, having the elements around wayfinding. So big format store, I don't want to spend my time going down aisles looking for products. Let me put the shopping list in on my phone, and then just guide me around the store and make it as simple as possible. All of a sudden, you can start to think about, well, can we gamify this somehow? Is there a Pokemon type element to help me get around and do my shopping? And again, just put a bit of fun into that experience.
Now, lots of people have moved on to online shopping over the past year. Maybe a lot of people who haven't done so before. How do the supermarkets retain them now that the country is opening up again? And do they want to?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the first part is relatively simple to say, but harder to do. I mean, the key point with online grocery is that you're doing something on behalf of the customer. You're taking care of the journey that they've always done for years and years. So the first thing is deliver on your promises. If I say that I want 40 items delivered, I'm spending £100 with you, and I want it delivered at 8 a.m. on a Monday morning, then make sure everything's arriving on time in full. No substitutions. And you've picked the items the way that I would pick them in the store. So it's the freshest possible items. So we know that those are the key things that really frustrate customers: the freshness of the products, the level of substitutions. If you get that right, you've got a really good chance of being able to retain customers. So that feels like the basics. You've got to keep then adapting the experience. Just make it more relevant to me. Make the recommendations more impactful. So it's the items that I really want to buy. Make that choice. So there's so many products you can buy out there. I don't need to see all of them. I just want to see the products that are relevant to me. So those are the types of things that you can do to get the customer more interested, get them coming back and shopping with you. You don't want to keep all customers, though. And that's a really, really key point. Some customers will be looking out for great deals. They will only shop with you for relatively small baskets. And the economics are so, so delicate with this particular channel that actually I would much, much rather try and spot those customers. It's not that I'm going to kick them out and say, you're not welcome. Of course not. But you are going to try and say, well, maybe I won't encourage that customer to come back. I won't send them the same emails. On the other hand, the customers at the other end of the scale, I want to keep hold of them. I'm going to do everything I possibly can to make sure that that customer is going to come back and keep spending at the level they have been.
And with margins being lower, is that the route to it? Is it basically ditching the customers that aren't making sense and specializing in the bigger customers, frankly?
There is definitely a little bit of that, but ultimately it's a scale game. And so that's why when we look at the way that grocers' businesses perform, typically when they're operating in larger urban areas, so big cities like London, Manchester, Birmingham, etc., the economics are just much better because they talk about this thing called drop density. So the more customers I can serve within a given area, and if I have my warehouse or my stores close to those customers, the economics are much, much better. So that's great. The more scale I can put through that, fantastic. And that's why you've seen the likes of Tesco being probably the best example grow very, very quickly in this area. But you need to have a big base of customers to be able to achieve those volumes. There's just no choice over the matter. So it's a delicate balancing act between getting those customers that you know are big enough and they're going to have the right sort of order profile, and just weeding out some of the ones that seem to be shopping in slightly lower volumes, or searching out the deals, and just try to stratify the customer base and make sure you keep the larger customers.
Now, Suzanne, social consciousness has become a much more important concept over the last year. We've recognised that supermarket staff are key workers, and as consumers are more conscious about how everyone's treated, what impact does this new awareness have on supermarkets?
I think you're right. I think people... that the relationship between people who work in supermarkets and consumers. I mean, I think you're already seeing people changing the language, by the way, in terms of, you know, the humanization of the whole sort of value chain, but particularly in that interaction and watching these people sort of working late hours, working really hard to keep the shelves filled. Yeah. And then equally being the key, you know, looking after the vulnerable when they were sort of going into the physical stores, trying to make sure that the orders are fulfilled. And that was their role during that. And that's really raised that visibility. And I think, you know, even before the pandemic, they were still, you know, Matt mentioned before about the rise of e-commerce and, you know, people picking fruit and veg in the stores and fulfilling orders. You know, they are almost they're the human face of a lot of the supermarket brands. They're the people that you see doing what you want, that you want them to demonstrate the same care that you would in terms of choosing those products and looking after them. And I think that has just been absolutely heightened as part of lockdown. Equally, there is the local impact as well and local communities. I mean, I think there's something like 2/3 of consumers have really started to identify, or shoppers, I should say, have started to identify they want to support local communities. And a lot of those workers in a lot of these supermarkets are part of their local community. And therefore, to see them still retained in jobs, to see jobs, and that diversity and inclusion, and making sure that those people are well looked after, that does have a real personal impact. And, you know, people will make choices, you know, if they see a supermarket behaving badly with those sorts of workers, then shoppers will vote with their feet, and they will change their shopping behaviours. They will actively, if they can, obviously depend on their economic circumstances, will choose to behave differently and to shop differently. And, you know, that sense of purpose, that sense of community has just become absolutely heightened. Really heightened.
So this is really interesting, Matt. So this whole concept of local shopping has become so much more important. And over the past year, shoppers have really wanted to support all the small local businesses in the community, as Suzanne says. What can grocers do to provide that same local shopping feel whilst operating huge national and international operations? You know, do they have to have a range of stores, as you mentioned before, the mega stores and the convenience stores? Is it impossible to keep both going at the same time, to be local and to be a multinational?
Yeah, isn't it fascinating? I mean, the thing I would say first of all is I've loved the return of the small shop on the high street, and going out on a Saturday morning and seeing a queue of 30 people outside the butcher is just fantastic. I think, again, that's part of the spirit of retail that's really come to the fore over the last 12 months. It's not impossible for the majors to be able to adapt the range and start putting in some more of the local products. In fact, they do it already. So if for Welsh customers, for Scottish customers, they will have a certain proportion of the range which will be provided by local suppliers in that part of the country. But when you think about the way that their model is created, obviously it's a volume game again, right? So they need to have a certain number of products buying in bulk overall. However, I think they're going to need to face into reality and just accept that customers want, again, something that's slightly different in place, and something again that will draw them back into the shops. Focus on more local produce, more connections into the community at the same time. Balancing act to make sure that you're not taking everything out, and still making sure you've got the core of the core product range in place that customers want. But aiming for something like 10% of the product range coming through from local suppliers could actually be something that cements their place with their customer base. And actually, we see that in other countries around the world. In France, it's much more common to have local range provided by the large supermarkets, and they've managed to make the model work, although it's not straightforward, and often you're dealing with much smaller suppliers who are not so used to dealing with the huge supermarkets.
I was going to mention France, because that's my experience, that they're very good at sourcing locally. Does that effectively cost more, though? I mean, it must take a lot more management and administration to run things like that.
Yeah, it does, and it costs on both sides. So the price to consumers is typically a bit more expensive than we would have here in the UK. But also at the same time, the margins are less for the supermarkets typically across Europe. So the challenge there is to try and find the right mm-hmm. balance. What the French supermarkets do really well is often they empower the supermarket managers to give that sense of this is what my customers want. And obviously, if you have a much more franchise-oriented business model, so often it's the supermarket manager is the owner of that store. And so they're ordering from a centralized base of products where they're choosing 80% coming from the center, but then they're also able to go out to local mm-hmm. suppliers. They're starting to think about and move away from this very centralized model that we have within the UK, and just break apart around the edges. What would it look like if you said to a supermarket manager, all right, you now have 10% of the store space to range in the way that you want? I think probably it would scare most of the living daylights.
To begin with, yeah.
to begin with, but I think it would be great. And actually, when you consider it, a career in retail, and you want to go in and run a store, actually, that's where the fun mm-hmm. should be in that job. It's not doing the admin in the back of the store. It's out speaking to customers on the shop floor, understanding what they need, and then finding a way to be able to meet those needs. I think that's exactly what they should be focused on.
Then if you have local products, you chime more with your customers, and hopefully they love you more. And Suzanne, I guess the same goes for, you know, the concern about impact on the environment. What are the challenges for grocers in improving sustainability, and what are the opportunities available there? Because again, it makes that connection between what the consumers really want.
Yeah, I mean, before the pandemic, it's almost like, you know, BP. I think sustainability obviously is hot on everybody's agenda. The retailers sort of have it the worst of it, really, because if you think about most brands, you know, and most categories, you will look at the two or three things that really are driving the sustainability conversation. So it could be water, it could be plastic, it could be sourcing of ingredients. When you come to the retailers, especially the big supermarket groups, you know, it's everything. And the consumer, the shopper, that's their front, that's their shop window. That's what they look at. They look at the retailer and say, well, you know, you should be doing more around multiple fronts when it comes to sustainability. And, you know, a lot of people are very confused by sustainability. You know, we get lots of different messages. You think you're doing the right thing, and then other information comes out and you have to change, and you think, oh, you know. So I think the retailer has this unenviable position, really, of not only sort of setting out its stall in terms of what it needs to do to drive sustainable behaviours, but equally make sure that they do that in a way that really connects with their shopper base and really empowers them and helps the consumer and doesn't add to that level of confusion. Yeah. So it's really, you know, by making these choices, by changing your behaviors in this way, people can feel good and can make, you know, can come back and can continue with those behaviors. So the retailer has got, as I said, multiple, they've got, they'll have all the fashion industry challenges around, you know, the societal impacts in terms of environmental, where the ingredients come from, good working practices in countries. And then equally, you've got the planetary impacts, etc. So, you know, it's difficult. I actually do feel quite sorry for retailers in terms of how they manage that. And working collaboratively with suppliers and with multiple suppliers to get those strategies right is really key. And then, of course, we have the pandemic, which absolutely has heightened people's awareness of that, particularly, I would suggest, around food waste. So I think I was looking at some of the stats from Waitrose, actually, and they talk about 91% of the over 55s, you know, trying not to waste food, but will, you know, during the pandemic, and will continue to try to do that. And you've got lots of people. It's suddenly packaging, plastic, you know, suddenly everybody's at home eating. So you're seeing all of this in your actual, you know, in your bins. And it's like, wow, suddenly this has become much more personal. So I think the retailers are suddenly responding to that. So we are starting to see, you know, moves to investments in things like refill stations. So actually, how do we make that easy for consumers to make some of these shifts, to be able to reduce plastic, to reduce packaging in ways that make sense and can still give people a sense that there's no contamination, that foods are protected. You know, that's always been the role of a lot of packaging. How do we help consumers to make some of those transitions? And that emphasis on ease, I think, will be one of the key levers that retailers will need to play with. You know, most people show an intent or a desire to make changes in behaviors that are more in keeping with saving the planet and helping, you know, the more societal parts of sustainability. But sometimes, you know, when you've got a fixed amount of money, time, sometimes, you know, some of these choices, if it's really difficult, you'll find that most people will not make the shift. So the retailers and doing those initiatives, making it visible, making it fun. Matt talked about gamifying things, you know, creating some of those mechanisms that allow them to manage multiple drivers of sustainable behavior, I think is going to be, will be the game changer for us as we move past this pandemic.
And then conversely, in terms of that's how you've been talking about how supermarkets lead consumer change. How about when consumer tastes change themselves, such as the phenomenal rise of veganism and also ideas like fermented foods? I mean, how are there some good examples of supermarkets responding in good ways and bad ways to how the demands from consumers change?
Yeah, I mean, if I talk from a consumer perspective, I'm sure Matt will also have some of the inside track on that. But I think what I can see is a lot of the retailers really starting to, as I said, I put an emphasis on democratizing and taking some of the confusion and the hype out of some of the growth categories and looking to try to make it easy for consumers to access some of those categories that are now starting to emerge. You know, some of these products are quite expensive. We all get very excited about plant-based, but, you know, they're expensive. They're not, you know, relative to you know, dairy or meat or, you know, some of the items that we're more used to. Some of these products they're 3-4 times as expensive in some instances. So I think the supermarket's really sort of trying to work hard with suppliers and with startups to get that best mix of products and to keep an eye on innovation that makes sense, that equally can pace with consumers' tastes. And I know that they spend, you know, some of our retailers that we've worked with are investing quite heavily in trying to identify some of these trends, looking ahead and which are the ones that they believe will have traction with consumers, and therefore how do they cast the net to look for suppliers, be on the front foot, work with some of the startups that are out there, and see which ones they want to bring into their choice set and really offer to consumers. So, you know, that they are definitely very active, more active now, and perhaps more agile in terms of working with working in innovation in different ways to make sure that they're offering consumers variety, but variety that will meet different types of consumers rather than just one group of consumers, which has always been part of their role. You know, this idea of different types of products and democratizing some of the trends that are out there and giving access to those for people.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, Steph, if I can jump in with some examples. We had a great conversation with a client of mine a few years ago who said, wouldn't it be fascinating if we could spot the next food trends, and for my customers to be able to put the products on the shelf before they know it's even a trend? How can I do that? And so we actually helped them build a food trend analysis tool, which scours the web, looks at social media to be able to understand exactly what's happening, and particularly not just in the UK, much as we might think that we're at the head of the food trend, but actually if you think about places like Brooklyn in New York or Melbourne in Australia, a lot of trends also coming out of East Asia now as well. How can we capitalize on what's happening there so that we can then work with all of our suppliers to then be able to get those products on the shelf, you know, by the time that things have caught up? Because we have social media, these trends go faster and faster every year. So they're very much global in nature. And one of the things the client said to us is that with their supplier base, there is one report that the industry uses, and 88% of the supplier base were all using the same food trend report. Well, if you're using, first of all, a paper-based report, and then second of all, you're all using it, it's no surprise that we end up with very similar products going onto the shelves. So that's why, to Suzanne's point, we're now starting to see retailers invest in their own tools to be able to go after these, understand the trends, and particularly what's going to be most relevant to their own customer base, and then get those products on the shelves. The question then is, well, how do I know which products to take off the shelf?
I was going to say that. When do you drop the trend? You need an algorithm for trend dropping as well as for trend picking up, don't you?
Exactly. So that's exactly what these trend analyses do, is to be able to spot what's dipping down. What are the core products? Because you'll have things. Well, how do I know if chicken is on trend at the moment? Because people eat chicken all the time. People eat beef all the time. But obviously now we've got the sentiment that comes with beef and the effect that it has on the planet. So you need to start separating these things out and understand the nuances behind the trends. Is it a positive trend? Is it a negative trend that's reacting against it? And so understanding all of these things and then working out what's the economic trade-off of me taking one product out to replace it with this new one. Actually, the supermarkets already have those tools largely in place. They already use those. So it's more about injecting new data sources and giving them comfort over what used to be very much a gut reaction for the buyers to say, I think this product will sell well. No, now you should know that product will sell well. You've got data that backs up all the decisions you're trying to make.
And while we're talking about the concept of making data-driven choices, I think this is where we really have to talk about the big A. Amazon continues its efforts to move into the grocery category. How do grocers compete? Are people terrified, or are they just thinking, Amazon, you don't know what you're getting into, mate?
Yeah, I think it's it maybe has taken a little bit more time for Amazon to get into grocery in the UK than people thought. We obviously had Amazon Fresh launching a few years ago. We had things like Amazon Pantry as well. And whilst it might have been slower, it is starting to build up a bit more of a head of steam. We've got Amazon Go now opened up in a couple of locations within sort of semi-suburban London areas. And I think they will go much more into physical retail in the same way that they are in the US with Whole Foods, how they do that and whether they need to make another acquisition to be able to do that in sort of in the right sort of scale. Only time will tell. It's pretty hard to be able to compete against them, as we've seen in all the other retail categories. To a certain extent, there's a race to the bottom in terms of price. Amazon will have the best price. Most people in non-grocery categories are starting their product search journey on Amazon. They're not starting on Google anymore. They're just going straight to Amazon, finding the product. I'm sure both of you, like me, are probably getting multiple Amazon orders, packages arriving on a daily basis. But in food, there is the opportunity to be able to, I think, be a little bit smarter and be able to compete against them. Part of it is what we've already talked about, the experience in the store, having great produce in the stores and putting the theater back in. From an online perspective, I think it is about the quality of the user experience, the customer experience up front. The UK market has had online grocery now for getting on for 25 years, and so we know what we're doing, and the user experience is typically better than Amazon has, but the back end is also similarly important. Use your drivers to be able to that are providing the groceries to the customer. Can they be a point of difference? Can they have a bit of a conversation with the customer and be that human face of what essentially is a very digital transaction with the customer? There are definitely ways to be able to compete, but I think if grocers thought it's been hard for the last few years, they've got another thing coming over the next few as Amazon scales up.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, a bit of a quantum shift in the questions here. Suzanne, the past year has also made us think about our own health. And I think people are much more aware of a lot of different concepts around health.
Yeah.
Is there an opportunity for retailers to steer the future of health and the future of buying for health?
Ooh, that is a big question. I think health, it's changing quite a lot. We're seeing the shift from health to well-being. So it's much broader and all-encompassing. It's no longer just, you know, back in the days where it was maybe just about diet. That's still really important and has perhaps been heightened post-pandemic with the, I think it was a phrase that I heard from one of our team, pandemic 15, the extra 15 pounds that people are putting on post-pandemic lockdown. I think that's the average. I don't know. But I think we've definitely seen a whole shift towards more emotional health, mental health, and there's more to come. You know, the whole area of immunity protection that's been heightened again as part of the pandemic. It was always there, but again, it's on its way. I think the question is, you know, what is the role of retailers, as you said, in curating this? You know, do they control? Do they limit? Do they start to remove things from shelves? Do they start to influence choice? Do they educate? And I think it's quite a fine line, really, between offering, you know, availability of things, but equally they're having a stance around health and well-being. Because, you know, we're going to cover this in another podcast, but, you know, indulgence, pleasure in food is just as important as things that are healthy and are either proactively good for us, you know, things that positively add positive goodness to our lives, as well as things that, you know, removing things that are negative or are considered bad for our health or our diet. Mm. And I think the retailers, you know, on the one hand, they are starting to develop strategies and have a stronger point of view and a purpose around health. Some retailers, others will probably just hold back and wait for regulation. You know, and regulation's coming. It's already starting to hit from, I think, the middle of this year into next year. You know, we're starting to see, you know, what they call high in fat, sugar and salt products, you know, being controlled. They will no longer be allowed to be promoted in certain ways as they are currently. So legislation is coming in that will probably mean that retailers don't have to make that conscious choice, you know, but they will have to work within those parameters. But I do think, and I'm happy to see them really start to do more around fresh food and start to promote more of that freshness. And again, to try and offer it to multiple types of consumers rather than just high disposable income consumers. And I think, again, really making sure that there's clear navigation in store. They are actually, you know, grabbing hold of lots of healthier items, making sure they are visible. They're mixed up in multiple categories rather than just parked in a very dusty, dark part of the store. You know, they're really trying to bring that out and to help consumers and shoppers make the right choices, probably without being, you know, waving the finger and making people feel, you know, shame because they are buying, you know, a huge bag of chocolates, etc. You know, you should be able to enjoy those things just as much as the healthier items. But it's a difficult one. It's a fine line for a retailer. For a branded manufacturer, you can have a much stronger point of view and you can really, you know, map out what you are for and what you're against. But for a retailer at the moment, they have to, it's a broad church, isn't it, really, in terms of the items that they have to stock and how they support their shoppers and their consumers in a positive way.
And yet it's part of the dilemma, isn't it? Because we all look to retailers actually for both the inspiration in terms of what we should be eating, but also a bit of the education value as well. The economic model is such that the retailers have to work with certain brands. That's where they get a lot of the profits from, is building the relationship with certain brands. You are starting to see some retailers introduce new formats, though. So in the States, there's a business called Rally's that have a new concept store called ONE, which is exactly where they've made conscious, healthful choices for their customers. Now, they deliberately put it further away from their other Rally's stores, so you can't necessarily do the comparison between the two, but it's exactly going after that to see, well, what happens if we create a store where we've actually taken out, you know, not all of the products that have high in fat, high in sugar, whatever it might be, but they've made choices for the customer, so it's easier to be able to go in and have a much healthier basket of products as you check out.
It's a very interesting idea, isn't it? Okay, now we could carry on talking about this for hours, but we need to wrap up. So, Suzanne, first of all, for you, in 10 years' time, what would your dream grocery experience look like for you personally?
For me personally, actually, the word is personal. I think, you know, personalization is on the increase on multiple fronts, and I think Matt mentioned something when he first started about I actually would like a much more personal and personalized experience with a retail store as opposed to just an online transaction. So much more of a dialogue, and you know, the prompting me around certain products that suit me, my personal needs, and actually probably helping me to avoid some temptation might be quite helpful. But I think literally sort of being able to curate something that gives me inspiration and convenience that is absolutely for me, not for a group of people like me, but for my needs, and then to be able to adapt that over time. I mean, that would be an amazing step forward. And I building, you know, part of this loyalty building and part of this humanization and connecting to people. I think that could, I don't know about the commercial model around it, but I think it's happening in other categories and it's happening in food. So why would it not start to happen more and more on the retail side?
I love the idea there are a few sliders that you could have on, you know, temptation issues up a bit, feeling indulgent, you know, have a few different things that would change the algorithm for you. Okay, now, Matt, I'm interested in digital grocery in the future. I mean, I think everyone is. Where's it going to be? Could give us your wild predictions about where digital grocery will be in 2031.
So I think if you think about where we are today in terms of e-com penetration, I think it's going to be north of 25%, possibly above 30%, which is double where we are today, even after the pandemic. So many more people shopping online for their groceries. I think, as Suzanne said, it'll be much more personalized. And if you think about the advent of the Internet of Things, it won't necessarily be you doing your shopping. It will be the various devices that you have around you, at least making the suggestions of what they think you need. Certainly all the staple items, you'll have devices looking at your cupboards, at your fridge, listening to what you're having, what you're talking about. both in terms of ordering the items and then also creating the inspiration to say, this is what I think you might be after this this week. Hopefully, you don't notice that that is happening, because that is the art of personalization, yeah. Right? You don't want to know that Big Brother is looking at you and there's an algorithm suggesting this. I think the other big factor, and we'll start to see this more and more, is that the delivery of your groceries probably won't have a human element in 10 years' time, or at least not every delivery that you have. So we'll start to see many more autonomous vehicles on the road bringing the groceries. Will it be drones flying through the air to be able to deliver them? Possibly. Again, lots of trials that are going on that side. But back to what we said up front, that this channel is really a difficult economic channel to serve. And so if you can do anything you can to be able to reduce down the cost, a lot of that comes through labor, by introducing things like drones, little vehicles on the road with no human labor attached to them, I think that'll be a key driver. And all of a sudden, you might then start to see the shift in behavior of the retailers saying, now we can start to make reasonable profit margins off this, and we can start to invest much, much more heavily on this side. And actually, we might start making more money from digital grocery than we make in the physical stores. And that's a real mindset.
Yeah,
shift.
Absolutely. It's, as it goes back to what you said earlier on, it's, you know, the margin needs to be there. Otherwise, it's not going to happen at all. Well, Matt Jeffers and Suzanne Robinson, thank you so much for talking with me. It's absolutely fascinating looking at the future of grocery. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters. And this episode is in partnership with Accenture. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from nootropics to future brands. Follow us to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Thanks for listening.